I call this meeting of House Finance to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:35 p.m. on Thursday, February 9th. Present today are Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Colom, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Johnson. Today we will be hearing from about Alaska's oil tax regime, but first of all, let me just say thank you to our moderator, Emma Turner from the LAO, and our Finance Secretary, Leah Frazier, for working with us today. Today, presenting on the order of operations, we will have Dan Stickle, the Chief Economist for the Department of Revenue. And if you would like, Dan, if you would like to come forward and put yourself on the record and then introduce whoever you would like to have come join you. And seeing no questions immediately, you can begin your presentation. Thank you.
Sure. For the record, Dan Stickle, I'm Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. I'm going to try to do this myself at the table. I believe I have a couple, I should have a lifeline on the phone, maybe, if necessary. So thank you for the opportunity to present the order of operations presentation. The purpose of this presentation is to give a high-level overview of how the production tax works for the North Slope. A lot of this will be a refresher for some of you on the committee, but really want to provide a high-level overview to make sure that new members of the public, new staff, understand the basics of how our current oil and gas tax system works.
Very good.
So slide two is a list of acronyms throughout the presentation. In our tax code, there's a lot of acronyms. I will try to avoid using them as much as possible as I go through the presentation, but just wanted to provide this slide as a reference as we go through the slide deck. So in terms of how we've organized the presentation today, looking at slide three, we'll start with an overview of the major sources of oil and gas revenue, looking at what we have and how it works. The presentation is intended to not to discuss the policy of whether the current provisions are good or not, but really to explain the nuts and bolts of the current system to aid in future policy discussions. We'll start by looking at all the sources of revenue to the state, and then we will step through a detailed discussion of the production tax in particular and each step of the calculation there. The focus of the presentation is on North Slope oil because that's where the majority of the state's production and petroleum tax revenue comes from. Slide four, before I jump in, is kind of a disclaimer. So we're taking a very complex tax system and breaking it down into easy to understand pieces. There's some simplifications that we make in putting the presentation together. Want to point out that I'm an economist and not an auditor, and so anything I say is not tax advice, and is not an official tax interpretation. So jumping into the meat of the presentation, slide five touches on the four sources of oil and gas revenue to the state. So the state receives a royalty based on the gross value of production for any production on state land. Typical royalty rates are 12.5% or 16.67%, but those rates do vary. The state has a corporate income tax that applies to most, but not all, of the oil and gas companies. The corporate income tax is based on worldwide income apportioned to Alaska. We receive a property tax. That's a tax of 20 mils or 2% of the assessed value of the property. That's applied to property anywhere in the state and within the state's 3-mile limit offshore. Any taxes on oil and gas property by municipalities are allowed as a credit against the state tax so that the total oil and gas property tax levied on companies is 2%, regardless of the municipal rate. And then finally, the production tax, which is the focus of most of this presentation on the next several slides.
I have a question on the property tax. So is that, so 2% no matter where in the state, the state gets the assessed 2% on top of the municipal property tax?
Chair Johnson, the property tax is levied at the 2% rate, and any municipal tax up to the 2% is allowed as a credit against the state tax. So the owner of the property will pay the 20 mils or 2% regardless of what the municipal tax is.
I see. And so, like in the unorganized areas, or the state gets the 20 mils, or is there, I mean, I've always kind of, I know I should know this, but I mean, in the unorganized area, how does the state receive the property on the, I mean, property tax?
Sure, Chair Johnson. So in the unorganized borough where there is no municipal levy, the state receives the full 20 mils tax. In an area where there is a borough, the state's going to receive a smaller portion.
Thank you. That's what I thought. Okay, thank you. Representative Hanner.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. On that same point, there are three main municipalities who receive that property tax: Fairbanks, Valdez, and North Slope. Are any of them receiving the full 20 mils, and so the state's not getting any, or how close do they come?
Sure, Representative Hannon, through the chair. So I'm looking at page 53 of the fall 2022 Revenue Sources Book, which has a chart that shows a distribution for fiscal year 2022 between state and local. There were the city of Valdez is levying at the full 20 mils, and so the state is not receiving any property tax for oil and gas property in Valdez. All the other municipalities as of fiscal year 2022 were levying less than the full 20 mils.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I follow up on that? Yes, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Stickles, and so it's entirely, as current law says today, it's entirely at the discretion of the municipality whether to occupy that full tax availability.
Sure, Representative Josephson, through the chair. Yes, it's up to the municipality to set the municipal rate. They are limited. They can't tax oil and gas property at a rate higher than other property in the municipality. But yeah, it's up to the municipality if they want to go the full 20 mils or something less.
Thank you.
So slide 6 shows a 5 years of revenue from these various revenue sources, as well as oil prices and oil production. So we included on this slide two years of history, the current year, which is fiscal year 2023, and then 2 full years of forecast revenue. The property tax shown here is the state share only. The municipalities in fiscal year 2022 received about $450 million above and beyond the state share. Corporate income tax, as we mentioned, applies only to the C corporations in the state, which is most but not all of the corporations. And we had some temporary impacts in fiscal year 2021 related to refunds that were paid out due to losses in tax year 2020 with the COVID recession. But we are expecting the corporate income tax to bounce back. It did bounce back last year, and expecting robust returns for the next several years. Production tax, which is the state severance tax on oil and gas, that'll be the focus of most of the presentation here. That's entirely general fund revenue. Looking at royalties, this includes bonuses, rents, and a significant share of royalties are dedicated to the permanent fund and the school fund. And then two smaller sources of oil and gas revenue any settlements as a result of an assessment or dispute are deposited to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And then the state also receives a share of revenue from the National Petroleum Reserve for any bonuses, rents, or royalties there. That's been a fairly small revenue component historically, with production coming online from the Greater Moose's Tooth unit. We've seen that the National Petroleum Reserve royalties have increased, and we're expecting the Willow Project would also significantly increase that particular revenue source.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Stickle, is that NPRA shared revenue formula set in federal statute, or in particular looking at the future of Willow Project, is it negotiated when it comes online?
Sure. Representative Hand, through the chair, I believe it's set by federal statute. It's a 50% share back to the state of the revenue received, and then important to note, there's specific provisions around how the NPRA revenue can be used. The state is required to use that for benefit of communities impacted by the oil developments.
One follow-up. Is the entirety of the 50% share that comes to the state has to go to the impacted communities? I'm seeing the nod.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So none of it would come to the state general fund?
Correct.
Representative Scapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, so quick question. I see we are using the fall revenue forecast for the current projections. How far off are we on FY22 from the fall revenue forecast, given the current price of oil?
Sure. Representative Stapp, through the chair. So we put together a monthly cash flow update in Department of Revenue, and actually we'll be putting that together next week. Based on the January update, we were really, really close for fiscal year 2023 and 2024. So we actually did not meet the 10% threshold for sending out an official notification, but prices and revenue are tracking very close to the forecast so far.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'm looking at these numbers for the forecast and wondering if you could help me with projecting out for Willow, for example. I understand that Santos versus Conoco may be different with regard to production, and their ways that we're providing credits for one versus the other. Can you help us understand that and how it might be reflected in terms of dollars or revenue back to Alaska?
Sure. Representative Galvin, through the chair. So the Santos, they are the manager of the Pica project on the North Slope, and then Conoco is the manager of the Willow project. Mm-hmm. Both of those projects would be subject to property tax, production tax, and then to the extent the companies involved are subject to corporate income tax, they'd be subject to corporate income tax. Where the two projects differ is how royalties apply. And I actually have a slide towards the end of the presentation that looks at how royalties differ based on the land ownership.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, following up on the previous question, so the severance tax structure for the two projects just addressed is identical, and the royalty is decidedly not identical. And so Willow has great economic value, but because it's on federal land, apples to apples, Pica would have more value to the state. Is that generally fair?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. So in terms of state royalty, since Pica is primarily on state land, whereas Willow is in the NPRA, the state would receive more relatively more revenue on a royalty revenue per barrel basis from the PICA project.
Follow.
And royalty in the 2014-2015 timeframe was, relative to production tax, very, very significant. It was a larger part of our total take. And now it's occupying its more traditional second share position in terms of its value to the state. Is that right?
Sure. Representative Josephson, through the chair. So whether royalties or production tax bring in more revenue to the state is largely a function of where oil prices are. Since the production tax is based on it's based on a net tax, so it's very progressive to price, whereas royalties are based on gross value. If you have relatively higher oil prices, you'll tend to have higher production tax receipts, and then if you have relatively lower oil prices, you'll tend to have royalties exceeding the production tax. So we did have several years in the 2010s where production tax generated significantly more revenue than royalty. But for the last several years, generally royalties have generated a little bit more than production tax.
Thank you.
Thank you. So slide 7 shows kind of the overall order of operations for the state's fiscal system, big picture. So royalties come first. Those are based on the land ownership, and the owner of the land gets their share of oil off the top before any taxes are calculated, regardless of if it's a state owner, federal owner, or private landowner. Then we move on to the property tax. State and local property taxes are considered, the upstream property taxes are considered lease expenditures for purposes of calculating the production tax. And then they're also deductible against corporate income taxes. The third step of the overall order of operations is the production tax. As we mentioned, that's after deducting royalties. That's after allowing for property taxes. But then the production tax actually becomes an allowable deduction in calculating corporate income tax. When you're looking at the worldwide income, you can subtract all of your property and production taxes. And then finally, the state corporate income tax is further allowed as a deduction in calculating the federal corporate income tax. So when we're looking at the full fiscal system, this is just kind of the order that we look at the different pieces here.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. One more quick question with regard to investment dollars and whether or not the Conoco project versus the Santos project, is there the same treatment? My understanding is that investment dollars in Conoco, they could put that off or receive a tax treatment differently than investment dollars in Santos. If you could help me understand that, I appreciate it.
Representative Galvin, through the chair. So we can't speak to specific companies. So I want to be careful there when we're talking about specific taxpayers. But it is true that an incumbent producer that has existing production and existing revenue on the North Slope, they can offset those revenues with investments in new production, whereas investments by a company that does not have existing production, they're treated a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the elements that I'll highlight as we go through the production tax calculation.
Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, so I'm looking back at fiscal year 21-22. Right? So all these amounts down here, is that's how much money the state got. So in 21, we got $1.6
billion. Representative Kronk, through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. So sit there and do my math. So we're getting about, the state's collecting about 20% of the value of a barrel of oil, give or take. So if it's $54 average, we're getting about $9 a barrel. I'm doing some calculations. And then if we get 91, we're getting 22. So, and I think the reason I'm asking this is because I don't think anybody else in Alaska knows how much money per barrel the state's actually collecting. Because that's a common question that we always get. What are we getting? You hear some people say we're only getting 5% of what barrel, the value of a barrel of oil. But if I look at, you know, with all these calculations, it's looking to me like whatever the price of oil is per barrel, we're, the state's going to bring in approximately 20% of a barrel of oil. Am I far off or close?
Sure. Representative Kronk, through the chair, and we actually, we provided, for the other body, we provided some information about how the cash flows from a typical barrel flow out to the different producers, and we'd be happy to provide that to this committee as well. I think that would be instructive to answering that question. One thing that's important to look at when you're talking about where does the value of the barrel go is a significant share of the value of the barrel is for costs. So there's the transportation cost of getting the oil to market. Those are averaged around $10 a barrel, typically. And then there's the lease expenditures, the cost of production. So when we look at the distribution of the value of a barrel, we like to look at the distribution of production tax value, which is after accounting for all of those costs. How do the profits share out between the different entities?
Okay, thank you. We can go into more of that later. So
yeah.
Thank you.
And we would appreciate getting that information to the committee members. I wanted to just make note that this is a order of operations, and we want to go through the higher level points. So on page slide 19, it looks like you talk about the petroleum by land type and so on. So, I mean, when you get into specific fields, maybe we can hold those questions until we get to slide 19. Thanks.
Sure. So if I may move on to slide 8. So this is the basic calculation of production tax for the North Slope. There's a lot going on this slide, so we'll spend several slides kind of unpacking it, and I'll walk through the calculation on a step-by-step basis, starting at the top and moving down. This is based on the income statement, which is presented in Appendix E of the Revenue Sources book. Did want to note the original Revenue Sources book incorrectly included 365 days in fiscal year 2024. We discovered after we hit print that we'd missed the leap year for this particular schedule here. So the slide in front of you and then the online version of the Revenue Sources book have been updated to reflect the 366 days in fiscal year 2024. So we'll start with our fiscal 24 forecast, which is for $81 per barrel of oil and 503.7 thousand barrels per day of production, which gives a total value of about $41 million per day of North Slope oil production. And we'll just kind of walk through how that value is split and taxed. So starting with slide 9, which is royalty and taxable barrels. Any royalty barrels, again, they are subtracted before accounting for taxes. That's that value accrues to the lease owner. We subtract any state royalty barrels as well as federal and private land royalty barrels. There's also a small portion of production that is outside of state jurisdiction. This would be currently a small portion of the North Star field. A field like Liberty would also fall into that category. Those also get deducted or subtracted here on this line. So after subtracting those royalty and other barrels, we end up with a little over 160 million barrels of production in fiscal year 2024 that are considered taxable, with a taxable value of about $13 billion for those barrels. On slide 10, the next step is subtracting transportation costs to arrive at the gross value at point of production. These transportation costs are all of the costs of getting the oil to market. Alaska North Slope oil is, when you see a price for Alaska North Slope oil, that's a price at market, which is priced in Long Beach, California. So we subtract the costs of marine transportation costs for getting the oil from Valdez to the West Coast, the cost of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff, which is the cost of getting the oil from the North Slope to Valdez, any costs of feeder pipeline tariffs from getting the oil from outlying fields to the first pump station of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and then some other minor adjustments, like adjustments for Quality Bank. So for fiscal year 2024, we're estimating an average transportation cost per barrel of $9.37, which gives an average gross value at point of production of $71.63 per barrel, and an average and a total gross value of about $11.5 billion for the fiscal year. So slide 11 looks at lease expenditures. The production tax is essentially a modified version of a net profits tax. So we allow deductions of both capital and operating expenditures in calculating our production tax. For capital expenditures, we use Internal Revenue Service guidelines to determine what is a capital expenditure. There is no depreciation provision in the production tax. So a company is allowed to deduct their entire capital expenditure in the year incurred. And then operating expenditures are any additional allowable lease expenditures outside of capital spending, which are typically the ongoing costs of operations and labor. So two terms to understand here. One is allowable lease expenditures and one is deductible lease expenditures. So the allowable lease expenditures are any costs in the unit directly associated with producing oil and gas. Not everything is an allowable lease expenditure. An example would be a financing cost, a lease acquisition cost, any costs of dispute resolution. Those are some examples of things that are expenses incurred by a company in doing business, but not considered an allowable lease expenditure. And then we use this term deductible lease expenditures. That's a term that we've developed within Department of Revenue. It's not part of the statute or regulation. It's a term of art to represent that share of allowable lease expenditures that can be applied against production against the value of production in the year incurred. So to the extent that a company has sufficient gross value at point of production, their lease expenditures would be considered deductible lease expenditures in calculating the production tax value. And then down at the bottom here, and this gets to the comment from Representative Galvin earlier about how lease expenditures are treated differently depending on the company making those lease expenditures. Any lease expenditures that are not deducted in the year incurred, those become a carried forward lease expenditure. And those can be carried forward and used as a deductible lease expenditure in a future year's tax calculation. We do have a provision in the tax code where those carried forward lease expenditures, they lose value at some point in time. So beginning on the 8th or 11th year after those carry forwards are earned, if the company has not achieved enough production to utilize those lease expenditures, they begin to decrease by one-tenth of value each year. So slide 12 is the calculation of production tax value. This is gross value less lease expenditures, basically the net profit for production tax purposes. So for fiscal year 2024, we are estimating a total production tax value of about $7.1 billion. Of course, that's going to be for about $44.10 per barrel. Of course, that value is going to be different for each company based on their different situation in terms of lease expenditures. But this production tax value, this is the number that we would look at when we're looking at government take, effective tax rate, anything like that. Slide 13 gets into the tax calculation once we've calculated that production tax value. So there's essentially two tax calculations. We show them slide by slide for illustrative purposes here. There's a gross minimum tax floor calculation and then the net tax calculation. So the minimum tax floor calculation is 4% of the gross value at point of production. As long as oil prices are over $25 per barrel, there's lower rates that would apply if the annual price was less than the $25 per barrel. Hope that is never the case. But for fiscal year 2024, based on the gross value at point of production of $11.5 billion, the minimum tax floor would be about $460 million.
Representative Stout.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, to Director Stickle, can you offset the minimum tax with OPEX and CAPEX? If your OPEX and CAPEX basically reductions ended up being a lot higher because of, let's say, you had very low price of oil, could you effectively offset the minimum tax floor with that?
Representative Stout, through the chair, so the operating and capital expenditures are part of the calculation for the net tax only. The minimum tax floor is based on the gross value, and so there's no allowance for operating or capital expenditures in calculating the tax floor.
Thanks.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, on that point, prior to, I think it was House Bill 247, there were ways for a company to legally receive a tax rate less than 4% of gross, and we've sort of sunsetted most of those. Am I right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, you're correct. So in the past, companies have been able to use certain tax credits to reduce their tax liability below the minimum tax floor. Currently, there is only one. There's one credit that can be used to take the tax liability below the minimum tax floor, and there's some provisions around that. That would be the per taxable barrel credit for GVR eligible oil, and I'll touch on that in a little bit more detail in a couple of slides.
Thank you.
So slide 14 looks at the other side of this side-by-side calculation. It's the more complex side. This is the net tax calculation. As we're going through this, I want to spend a minute talking about the gross value reduction and how that applies to the calculation of production tax value. So this is an incentive for new development. It provides a temporary incentive by excluding 20 or 30% of the gross value of qualifying new production from the production tax value calculation. So the 30% applies if you have a unit with qualifying new production and the unit is entirely state-issued leases with greater than 12.5% royalty. Any other qualifying new production would get the 20% benefit. And so that gets taken out of the production tax value before applying the tax rate. Other provision of the gross value reduction is any of the oil that qualifies for that provision receives a flat $5 per barrel per taxable barrel credit instead of the sliding scale credit that applies to all other production. The gross value reduction, it's a temporary benefit. It expires for after 7 years or after any 3 years in which oil prices have exceeded $70 per barrel. And so we subtract, in fiscal year 2024, we're expecting about $146 million reduction in production tax value for that gross value reduction, leaving a production tax value after the gross value reduction of about $6.9 billion. The statutory tax rate is 35% of that value, and so a little over $2.4 billion is the production tax before credits in fiscal year 2024. And then moving on to slide 15, so we do a comparison of the side-by-side between that net profits tax and the minimum tax floor, and the higher of those two calculations becomes the starting point for the tax before credits. In this case, the $2.4 billion net tax is expected to be the prevailing tax, higher than the $460 million minimum tax floor. So the major tax credits in place are the per taxable barrel credits. There's two per taxable barrel credits. There's one that applies to gross value reduction eligible oil. That's a flat $5 per barrel tax credit. And then there's a separate tax credit that applies to all other oil. It's a sliding scale credit. The sliding scale ranges from $8 per barrel when the wellhead value is less than $80 per barrel. In this case, the wellhead value, which is the gross value at point of production for fiscal year 2024, we're expecting that to be $71.63, so the $8 per taxable barrel credit would apply. But that credit phases out in $10 increments of wellhead value. And if the wellhead value were to exceed $150 per barrel, then the sliding scale credit would phase down to zero. These per taxable barrel credits, any of these, if they're not used in the year incurred, they're forfeit. There's no provision for state purchase or carry forward of these credits. The sliding scale per taxable barrel credit cannot reduce tax liability below the minimum tax floor. The $5 per barrel credit for GVR eligible oil, if a company does not use any sliding scale credits, then potentially they can use that credit to reduce their tax below the minimum tax floor. And that gets to the comment from Representative Josephson earlier. Small amount of other tax credits against liability. These include primarily, there was a small producer credit that's being gradually phased out, but we do have a couple of small companies that are still able to claim that. But after deducting all of those credits, we arrive at a total tax after credits of about $1.2 billion for fiscal year 2024.
Good. Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
This is a little more of a comment than a question, but am I right, Mr. Stickle, then in around FY12, that $1.2 billion number was about $6 billion? And I only note that because our constituents want us to live within our means, which is a good principle, but our means are, at least in that category, are much less than they were, albeit in a very peak year. Do I have my number right, that's the kind of variability we've seen in production tax?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, you're correct that production tax has been very volatile. The schedule I have in front of you starts in fiscal year 2013, when production tax was a little over $4 billion. A few years later, it was $126 million in fiscal year 17. So production tax, with having the progressive elements and being a profits-based tax, it varies a lot with oil prices.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the director, just curious, the wellhead value price here, to apply the sliding scale, for the per barrel credits to be less than 80, we're factoring the transportation costs before the wellhead value, so wouldn't that be like $90 instead of 80, since the transportation costs comes out before the wellhead value is calculated? So like in my head, when I hear oil at $80 a barrel, I'm calculating the per barrel oil credits, but reality it needs to be basically $10 more because transportation comes off. Is that right?
Representative Stapp, through the chair. So when you hear when you hear a quote that oil is at $80 per barrel, that's typically the destination value. And so we would want to subtract the $10 per barrel to approximate the wellhead value in Alaska. And then as far as the calculation of the per taxable barrel credits, the sliding scale calculation and statute specifically references the wellhead value, not the destination value. So jumping back into the presentation here, we were moving on to slide 16. This is just a couple of other items that get added to the tax calculation that we just walked through to determine the total production tax revenue that's received by the state in a given fiscal year. So these would include things like any payment of prior year taxes, any refunds of prior year taxes, a tax on private landowner royalties, any taxes on gas production on the North Slope, any tax liability for Cook Inlet production of oil and gas. We have two surcharges that add up to 5 cents per barrel of oil production, and then any adjustments for company-specific differences that make it so that the company-specific tax calculation that we use in our revenue modeling can vary a little bit from the aggregate calculation shown here. In fiscal year 24, we're estimating that those adjustments will add up to about $16.9 million for a total tax paid to the state of a little over $1.2 billion. All but $8 million of that is considered unrestricted general fund revenue. The $8 million is the conservation surcharge, and we do show that as designated revenue in the revenue sources book in the budget. And then for fiscal year 2024, after calculations of these taxes, we're estimating that there's a little over $880 million of lease expenditures that will be earned by companies making investments in the North Slope, but not able to apply those to production taxes in fiscal year 2024. And that $882 million will carry forward and be available to offset future production tax liabilities.
Representative Josephson.
That last comment through the chair, Mr. Stickle, is so confounding in that clearly we receive and the Treasury receives $1.236 billion. But when you're looking in the out years, assuming that production comes on and the carry forward lease expenditures can be utilized, it must make it incredibly difficult to make accurate predictions about where we'll be, say, in 2030. Am I right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair. So we maintain, we in Department of Revenue, we maintain a company-specific modeling of production tax liabilities. So we're actually keeping track of which companies are earning these credits, and we're estimating each company's production tax liability. And we're assuming that they will utilize the lease expenditures, carried forward lease expenditures, to the maximum extent possible. One of the uncertainties around the lease expenditures has to do with, I talked earlier about the provision that the lease expenditures decrease in value after 8 or 10 years. There is an uncertainty there in terms of when the lease expenditures will be earned and, you know, to what extent those will eventually decrease in value. So slide 17 takes the same analysis that we just walked through for fiscal year 2024 and looks at this across 5 years, so from fiscal year 2021 through 2025. We estimate that production tax value ranged from about $3.5 billion in fiscal year 2021 to $8.8 billion in fiscal year 2022, and then projecting slight decreases year over year based on the lower oil prices. And then the net tax paid to the state followed along with $389 million of production tax in fiscal year 2021, over $1.8 billion in fiscal year 2022, and then decreasing to a little over $1 billion projected in fiscal year 2025. At the bottom of the slide, we've added a couple of two new rows this year in response to some of the feedback we had to last year's presentation. So we've added an estimate of the total ending value of those carried forward lease expenditures. So we're expecting that by the end of fiscal year 2025, there will be nearly $3.3 billion of carried forward lease expenditures. Those are the expenditures that have been incurred by companies that do not have sufficient current year revenue to apply those against a tax liability. And those would then be available to offset future taxes for those particular companies. And then at the very bottom, we've added an effective tax rate calculation. So this is the effective tax rate based on production tax value. So it looks at what was the total tax paid to the state as a share of North Slope production tax value for oil. And you can see that that effective tax rate was 11% in fiscal year 2021 and then increased to 20% in fiscal year 22 and 23 with the higher oil prices.
Representative Marquez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. When we look at those figures for effective tax rates, how does our quote Alaska regime compare to effective tax rates in other regimes? Have you looked at that?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, that's beyond what I'm prepared to speak to today.
Okay. Just follow up then?
Yes.
The overall general trend then, projecting the future down in revenue, total taxes down a little bit. Is that all about price, projected price, or is production in any way affect that?
Sure. Representative Ortiz through the chair. So largely the effective tax rate is going to be a function of price and spending. Obviously, production is part of the story as well. We are looking at fairly stable production overall. But in terms of calculating your net profits tax, obviously higher price will increase tax, so would lower lease expenditures and vice versa.
Thank you.
Carry on.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stickle, I am, so looking at the bottom on slide 17, the carry forward lease expenses and then expenditures, those bottom two lines. And then, you know, FY21, it's just slightly more, the carry forward expenditures is slightly more than the net lease expenditures. It looks like it roughly doubles in 22, doubles in 23, but by 24, it's triple that, and by 25, it's fivefold. So is that because there's more, we're doing less development? So just help me understand how that multiplies, why it's increasing so steeply. Is it because we don't have anything for them to take the credit against?
Sure. Representative Hannon through the chair. So the carried forward lease expenditures is a fairly new provision of tax law. When we changed from allowing a tax credit for expenditures to this carried forward lease expenditures that becomes a deduction. And there's two lines here. The net new lease expenditures earned and carried forward, that represents the net carry forwards earned in a given fiscal year. And then below that, the total carried forward lease expenditures, that's a cumulative calculation. So you see that growing over time. In terms of looking at the net lease expenditures earned in a given year, we're expecting that value to be increasing each year, and that reflects significant new investments that are being made by companies that are not current producers, primarily.
One follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair. So, Mr. Stickle, as an economist, is there a risk by us doing that if there was enough investment that and all those expenditures, we paid them off, we would earn no tax in a fiscal year because we have allowed that compounding to happen.
Sure. Representative Hannon through the chair. So we wouldn't receive no tax. The carried forward lease expenditures, those are limited to the specific company and the specific development that incurred those lease expenditures. And they're also limited by the minimum tax floor. So those specific companies, if they have sufficient gross revenue in the future, they could choose to reduce their tax liability down to the minimum tax floor.
Thank you.
So slide 18 is kind of a little bit different take on the analysis that we've been walking through. This is a standalone calculation. It looks at what if there was a single taxpayer on the North Slope. We didn't have the regime where we have a bunch of different companies. We have incumbents. We have new producers. If we had one company that operated all of the fields and was making all of the investments. The primary difference here is that currently we are forecasting that there are some small companies that are not able to utilize the full $8 per taxable barrel credit, the sliding scale credit. If there was a single producer, we'd expect that they would utilize the entire $8 per barrel credit to offset tax liability. And that would give us a total production tax into the Treasury then would be about $1.19 billion in this scenario, as opposed to $1.24 billion in the official forecast. It's a small difference given the pricing in fiscal year 2024 at lower prices. The difference would be a little bit more significant. But what this slide really highlights is the impact of individual company economics on the tax, and that each company has its own portfolio of operations and investments and pays a little bit different tax levy.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. To that point, I wondered if you could help me. I remember reading in a book somewhere about how one governor was sorry that they did not, that they included it, the tax structure to be for their worldwide investments for a company, as opposed to just Alaska. And I'm not familiar with this deep enough to know what that means, but it feels like what you've just said applies in this case.
Sure. Representative Galvin, through the chair, I'll take a stab at what you're getting at there. So there's been some debate over corporate income tax in particular. Our current corporate income tax structure, we take a company's worldwide income and then we apportion that to Alaska, versus an alternative option that's been discussed and was utilized for a period of time in the past is to calculate a separate Alaska income for corporate income tax.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Stickle, I'm just sort of struggling with hypothetical scenarios on the carry forward lease expenditure. Because even though I think most people, certainly in this room and in the state, are cheerleading for success in the oil patch, there would be circumstances where if the PTV, if I've got that right, production tax, yes, the production tax was just marginally greater than the carry forward lease expenditures, we might be in a gross tax position. In other words, we may not, as a state, make a lot of money from that for our treasury. On the other hand, once those were retired, if they then were in the costs had been sunk and paid for, then the following year, everyone would come out a winner, theoretically. Do I have that sort of right?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, yes, that's the general situation there. So the idea with the carried forward lease expenditures is we give companies an opportunity to deduct their lease expenditures against a tax calculation. For an incumbent producer, they can deduct those in the year that they're incurred. For a new producer, we would allow them to deduct it in that future year once they have the sufficient production. Either way, a company gets to deduct those lease expenditures at some point. And then you're correct. Once a company has utilized any carried forward lease expenditures, they have a greater, potentially a greater net tax liability.
Thanks.
So the last few slides are kind of supplemental to the presentation, but I think provide some value. Slide 19 shows how petroleum revenues vary by land type, and this gets at some of the questions that were asked earlier about how Pica and Willow would be treated differently in terms of state revenue. The concept behind this slide is that not all oil is equal, and the revenue the state gets from oil production depends on where the oil comes from. So beyond, if there were to be any production beyond 6 miles offshore of state land, there's currently no production in this category. But if there was to be production in the Outer Continental Shelf, the state would receive no revenue from that oil. The state could potentially receive economic benefits as well as if that oil were to become throughput into the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, it could have a positive impact on the tariff for other oil, but we would not receive any direct state revenue. From the 3 to 6 mile offshore, the state does not apply any taxes, but we do get a share of federal royalties. We get 27% of federal royalties shared back to the state. There's currently a small amount of production that falls into this category. This would be a small amount of the North Star field. Liberty would potentially fall into this category, and there's some production in the Cook Inlet as well that falls into this category. Within land in the state and within the 3 mile limit, property tax, corporate tax, and production tax apply the same across all of those developments. Where we see the difference is in terms of how royalty applies. So state royalty obviously applies to any production on state land. Any production within the National Petroleum Reserve, it's a federal royalty. We get a 50% share back of that federal royalty with specific provisions around how we can use that money. Any production within the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, we would also get a 50% share back of any of that revenue. There's currently no restrictions around how we would have to use that 50%. Other federal land would receive a 90% share back, potentially. And then private land, this is primarily some of the native corporations are lease owners. And they have a private royalty that applies on that land. There's no sharing with the state directly. However, we do levy a tax on the private landowner royalty in the amount of 5% for oil and 1.667% for gas. So in terms of Pica and Willow, the Pica field would be primarily state land. There is a small portion of private land within the Pica field. And then the Willow field is in the National Petroleum Reserve.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Stickles, so I just want to make sure, because Willow's got a lot of airtime, the expectation of what the state general fund could receive off of Willow is pretty limited. Is it zero? So I understanding that we get that 50% of federal royalties, but that's dedicated money to the NPRA impacted communities.
Representative Hannon, through the chair, the revenue impact of Willow would be non-zero. So we would receive production tax, corporate income tax, and property tax would all apply, and those would all have a general fund component to them. And to the extent that we do see significant production from Willow, that would also reduce pipeline tariffs through increased throughput.
Thank you.
Slide 20 is just a little bit more information about the gross value reduction for the benefit of the committee. We talked a little bit about this earlier in the presentation. The gross value reduction, that was a new development incentive that was part of the Senate Bill 21 tax reform enacted in 2013. Again, it's a temporary benefit applying for 7 years or 3 years if oil prices exceed $70 per barrel, and provides a 20 or 30% exclusion of gross value from the net production tax calculation for those new developments. So a pretty significant incentive for new development. Slide 21 is it's a repeat of a chart that we showed a couple weeks ago when we were discussing the revenue forecast. But this shows how unrestricted revenue for fiscal year 2024 would change with different oil prices. Starting with the forecast price of $81 per barrel and $3.4 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue, excluding the permanent fund transfer. And around the oil price forecast, each dollar change in oil price would equate to about a $70 million change in unrestricted general fund revenue. The production tax has progressive elements to it. So once you get above about $90 per barrel, and this is where the $80 wellhead threshold takes effect for the step down of those per taxable barrel credits, once you get above the $90 per barrel, that per barrel revenue actually increases. And then similarly, once you get below about $70 per barrel, we have the companies start paying at the minimum tax floor generally between $50 and $70 per barrel. So once you get below $70 per barrel, the incremental value per dollar is actually a little less than it is around current prices. And slide 22 just puts this in table form and also includes fiscal years 2025 and 2026 for planning purposes. This is a table that's taken from Appendix A of our Revenue Sources book. And finally, last slide is slide 23. This was a slide that we added in response to a question from the other body and thought that it would be appreciated here as well. So this compares the effective tax rate at a range of prices for fiscal year 2024 to that statutory net tax rate of 35%. And what we can see here is that this is the total production tax paid as a share of production tax value at different prices, holding all else equal for fiscal year 2024. The lowest effective tax rate is observed at about $52 per barrel. That's a 9.8% effective tax rate. Once we get above $52 per barrel, the production tax levy is increasing with the net profits tax. And we see that start to approach, but never quite match up to that 35% statutory tax rate. And when prices are below that $52 per barrel threshold, we also see the effective tax rate increase. This is because the tax is governed by the gross minimum tax floor at those lower prices. And so their profit is decreasing faster then their gross value is decreasing. And so once you get below the $30 per barrel, we're actually we're levying a gross tax even as profits approach zero. And that was the end of the presentation. Happy to take any further questions.
All right. I see a question from Representative Cronk.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Chair, of the transportation cost, how much of that actually is the TAPS portion?
Sure. Representative Cronk, through the Chair, it's about half of the transportation cost is for TAPS. So for fiscal year 2024, we're forecasting a total transportation cost of $9.37 per barrel. $4.88 is the estimated TAPS portion of that.
Follow up. Okay. So if we hypothetically get these new fields online and we get more oil going down there, does that transportation cost drop? Or is it going to stay static?
Representative Kronk to the chair. So potentially that transportation cost could be stable or decreasing. We're actually forecasting fairly stable average transportation costs remaining under $10 a barrel through fiscal year 2031. And a large reason for that is that we're expecting moderate increases in production.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to the director, I'm just kind of hoping we could maybe speak to that 50% royalty share from the NPRA. So I kind of wanted to clear up any confusion. So that 50% royalty, though it would not go directly to the state for an unrestricted purpose, what purpose does that money actually require to go to, if you could speak to that, Director?
Sure. Representative Stapp through the chair. So there's a provision that the federal government requires that we use those funds to benefit the communities that are impacted by the oil development. My understanding is the state has a grant program that we use to distribute those funds to impacted programs and communities.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So my understanding, thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair to the director. So my understanding would be in this specific case of the NPRA, all those kind of wonderful folks who were in our offices from the North Slope Borough talking about schools that have burned down and needs in their communities, that money would be going directly to them. Is that correct?
Representative Stapp through the chair, it would be going to the impacted communities.
Thank you.
Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, Director, on your disclaimer page, Alaska's severance tax is one of the most complex in the world, and portions are subject to interpretation and dispute. Do the oil companies like our tax severance regime that we have here?
Representative Tomaszewski through the chair. So I would defer that question to the oil companies. As far as those two statements, you know, we've had numerous oil tax discussions over the years, and we've had several consultants have come in and say that, yes, our tax is one of the most complex in the world. And it creates a difficulty when there's uncertainties in the tax. We've worked through a lot of those over the years, but it is a criticism that some have made of our tax regime.
And a follow-up.
Follow-up.
And so you can't speak for the oil companies. How about the state? Does the state like, do you guys like this tax the way it's set up?
Representative Tomaszewski through the chair. So I would defer that as a policy question. From a purely personal standpoint, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, on one hand, I've made a career out of analyzing oil and gas taxes. On the other hand, it is tricky and complicated at times.
Absolutely. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Mr. Stickle, on that same point, isn't that complexity underlined because of the state reserving the subsurface rights? So surface ownership and subsurface ownership in most other jurisdiction is unified. So the taxpayer and royalty is clearer, but here in Alaska, we, as a state, reserve that subsurface right, and then we have this great distance where the transportation is across five municipalities. So that's the complexity to one degree, not just our order of operations, but our ownership and distance across jurisdiction.
Sure. Representative Hannon, through the chair, that's definitely part of it. Part of it is just that we've made many changes throughout the years, and as we've made changes, they've been kind of layered on top of other changes throughout the years.
Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, it's going to be more of a statement. After looking through this, I really relate this the oil tax to the BSA. No one really can explain how it works. In reality, but that's just a statement.
Thank you, Representative Kronk. Well, we have another question, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. Through the chair, just one quick question on these forward lease expenditures. Are these specific to a lease? Can those credits be used on other leases at the same company, or is it specific to that one lease?
Sure, Representative Tomaszewski, through the chair. So the carried forward lease expenditures, they are tied to a lease, and a company does need to bring that lease into production before it can apply those lease expenditures in their tax calculation.
And real quick, is there any kind of cap on that time or value?
Representative Tomaszewski, through the chair. So the cap would be that after 8 or 10 years after the lease expenditures are earned, they start to decrease in value if they haven't been used. So there is kind of a cap in terms of the time there. There's not a dollar amount limit to how much a company can invest and earn those lease expenditures.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. Mr. Stickle, your comment, two comments back. Isn't it true, though, that using the carry forward lease expenditures is not prohibited for a taxpayer like Conoco, where they're in production, they have to use they can use the lease expenditure when they're in profit, for example, closer to Pluto, and not in profit in another field, notwithstanding that they haven't brought the second field into production? Isn't there some exception there where whether or not they're in profit is a North Slope question, not a ring-fenced separate unit question?
Sure. Representative Josephson, through the chair. So if I'm understanding the scenario right, for an existing producer like a ConocoPhillips, that sort of company, if they have sufficient gross revenue and they make an investment in a new field, they are able to apply those lease expenditures in the year that they make the investment.
That's
my question. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
Looks like we're finished up. Our next, thank you for that in-depth presentation. It's always good to go back and look at that over and over again. So much appreciated, Mr. Stickle. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, February 10th at 1:30 p.m. We will receive a presentation from Devin Mitchell, the new executive director for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned.